All right. The Wisconsin Supreme Court has reconvened. The Honorable Chief Justice Jill Karofsky presiding.
Hello, please have a seat. Before we start, I just want to note that Justice Rebecca Bradley is joining us by phone. Justice Bradley, are you still on?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And as we did in the previous oral argument, she is going to let me know by text if she has questions, and I'm going to ask before each speaker sits down if she has any questions, just to make sure all her questions are answered as well. And also, before we start, I would like to recognize the pre-law students. Would you please stand up? All right, the future lawyers, hopefully, of Wisconsin or somewhere in the United States. Thanks for being here today. You can have a seat. I hope you can learn something from these oral arguments, and I'll just say that we need good lawyers in the state of Wisconsin, especially in our rural areas, and in the United States. Justice Dallet will be available after this oral argument to meet with you and answer any questions that you might have. She also said she had time to go through all your resumes and I'll give them up, so I'll make sure you take her up.
And she has jobs for you.
Right.
Wow.
There's lots of good career advice. I will call it our second case of the morning, still morning, which is Cincinnati Insurance Company versus James Ropicki. May I have the appearances, please?
Mark.
Good morning. I have 20 minutes, then you have 30 minutes, and then you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Agreed? Okay, whenever you're ready. I'm sorry. I do that all the time. 25, 30, 5. I was told there'd be no math in this job. That is not true. Whenever you're ready. Thanks for correcting me.
Anyway, said to move this up. Can you hear me?
We can,
Not
yeah.
going up and
It's
down.
not going up. Okay.
So I don't know why, but may it please the court.
I think there's, is there one underneath?
Yeah.
Usually there's a.
There we go.
There we go.
There, that's better. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Rattan. I represent Cincinnati Insurance Company. Every time, whether it's trial court or in this distinguished forum, I say my name. I think back to the very first argument I did going on 45 years ago, summary judgment argument. I'd been at the firm for 2 days and I had that thing backwards and forwards. I got up there, started giving my argument, and the judge stopped me and he said, "Counsel, why don't you start by saying who you represent and what your name is?" Well, I knew my name, but all of a sudden it went blank with who did I represent? So my lovely wife, who's here today, said to me before we came in, "Okay, Mark, who do you represent?" I got through that part of the oral argument anyway. I think the briefing in this case is very specific, with very specific citations to the record and to case law. So I'm going to take kind of a bigger picture here today, because I think as lawyers, we tend to, and everyone, including me, is guilty of this, overanalyze things, get too hyper-technical, and sometimes kind of get lost in the weeds and not see the forest through the trees. I remember a law professor of mine said, yeah, after you've been a lawyer for a few years, you get this irresistible urge when reading the paper to start highlighting things. So anyway, let's start with the freezing and plumbing exclusion. And I'm not going to get initially, at least in response to questions I might, but initially I'm not going to get too technical. Big picture, why is that exclusion there? The exclusion is there because insurers are not in the business of insuring the work of the insured's contractor or subcontractor or whomever. If there is defective construction, that is a matter between the insured and their contractor, and very possibly their contractor's insurer, if it may be covered, and sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, depending on what the defect is and what the resulting damages are. So why is it there? It is there to prevent insurers from covering for the insured's contractor and or the contractor's liability insurer. That's why it's there, and it has to be read in that context. And in that context, you say, okay, so what's the ensuing cause of loss exclusion all about? And I hearken to the part of the Arnold opinion, which hasn't gotten lost in this case, but it seems to have taken secondary role. It does get lost in some cases. And that is, there has to be a secondary cause for it to be an ensuing loss. And if there is not a secondary cause, then it is not an ensuing loss. And that gets us to the difference between the Arnold case from the Court of Appeals and this case, because Arnold did rely on the second prong of their test regarding there has to be a secondary cause. Things just can't happen in sequence and you say, oh, that's an ensuing loss. You have to look at, was there a separate cause? And Arnold was close in terms of what they said was the ensuing loss, which is a rainwater event after the defective power washing. And they said, okay, that, and I says, I don't know. I suspect it was a minor part of the damage, but they said that's an ensuing loss. But they said everything else, including other interior damage from the power washing, was not an ensuing loss because there was no secondary cause, secondary event, however you want to word it.
Do you remember in Arnold how long it was between the power washing and that event and the rain?
I don't remember specifically, but there was definitely a break in the causation. I want to say it might have been some weeks, but I'm not sure.
Do you think that's why the court has that second part of their statement where they talk about the causation and the second event?
Well, I think that's part of it, and I think that's part of what the Arnold court hung its hat on. And the difference here, which I believe I've made clear in my brief, or I certainly hope I have, is that there is no break in the causation here. Because in this case, it would be like if the power washing still hadn't stopped to this day. It just keeps power washing, and more water keeps coming in. Because the water never stopped entering the house, even on a sunny day. If water enters on day one and it's sunny on day two, that water is still in the house and it's still migrating because, water goes all over the place. I once had a hydrogeologist tell me the first thing you have to understand about water is it's always trying to go somewhere. And he was being in jest, but he was also being serious about how water moves, and it's in constant motion unless it gets bollocked up somehow.
Why do you say that?
What?
Well, I mean, we have a lot of factual disputes here, I think. But so you're, because I'm having a really hard time understanding why you think Arnold is not the same thing as this case. That is, I am, because you didn't ask us to overturn Arnold, so you're saying Arnold applies, and I don't understand what you mean about this break in causation. Is it because, like, what if it had rained the first day and water came in? Why isn't that still the same thing as Arnold? And that goes back to Justice Ziegler's question. Are you saying there has to be a certain amount of time in between? Like, what makes this different than Arnold?
You have to see if there's I can't put it in terms of time. There has to be a secondary cause or secondary
right.
event.
The rain is the secondary cause.
Right. Though.
How is the rain the same thing as construction, which left potentially assuming it that was the cause, which we don't know. But assuming that the hole is the cause, that's the defective construction, just like the defective power washing, that happened. And then sometime later, there's rain, whether it's a week, a month, a year, you're saying that doesn't matter. So why are they different? Why is this different than Arnold?
It's different because the defect in Arnold was the power washing. Okay, the
it's
defect
workmanship.
Here.
Would we say that's workmanship? Doesn't that fall within the policy just like construction does?
I think we are really confused about that, where you have what is a construction defect, which would be the cause, the secondary cause being the storms, and now the damage to the home. We don't understand how that cannot be an ensuing loss.
Well, under Arnold, I don't see how you distinguish Arnold.
Distinguish Arnold on the basis that in this case, in all the water intrusion cases from a defective construction, it's all the same event. Okay, construction.
It's all one big rain event?
I'm sorry?
Like a big rain event? Like, how did the water get there? Was there rain?
From defective construction, that's how it got there.
But how do you know that?
Well, we have proof of that, and they never refuted it.
Okay, but is that rain? Like,
well, it could be snow, it could be rain, it could be mist.
Why is that? But so in Arnold, there was an event outside, rain, snow, something that happened.
Could be a humid day.
I'm just having a hard time seeing why it's different than Arnold.
Can I back up just a little bit? I like your big picture thing, but we're getting into details.
I know.
So what I want to do is find out what we're reviewing here. And it is a summary judgment motion that was granted by the circuit court, and it was overturned by the Court of Appeals. The circuit court at the time reviewed the evidence before it and determined that there was no issue of material fact. I think because you presented expert testimony that the rain damage was might have been in the house, but it was a construction defect and rain seeped in the house that way. And there's no indication that there was a second cause of damage. And therefore, your position was it's excluded because there is an exclusion specifically in the insurance policy for defective workmanship, right? So
yes.
Okay. So when that happens and you present expert testimony that says this is defective workmanship, the other side agrees that there's defective workmanship, and then there's nothing refuting your expert testimony at the summary judgment stage, what else would a circuit court do? What evidence was presented that refuted what you said?
I don't believe there was any, and that's my whole point. Because when I deposed their experts, I specifically asked them, Mr. Anea, Mr. Carls, those were the two construction experts. And I specifically asked them, what caused the water to come in the house? And I walked them through our experts' reports. And they said they didn't know. And so there you have a dynamic where I think summary judgment is not only permissible, but warranted and mandated. Because if you say X is true, which is what my experts said, and the other side says, I don't know if X is true, that's not an issue of fact. And even if you attacked the credibility of the people who say X is true and say, oh, they're biased and their methods are terrible and everything else, unless you have an expert that says X is not true, then that's summary judgment. Because on summary judgment, we don't deal with credibility. You know, you take the facts as they are, and you don't get into credibility issues like you do before a jury.
So I'm not convinced that Arnold necessarily works against you because of that second part of causation that it talks about. Having said that, Arnold is a Court of Appeals case that's from quite a while ago. Do you have any idea how many times it's been cited with approval by this court or really any other court?
Well, as the Court of Appeals point out, I believe it was cited in one of the two cases from other jurisdictions that...
with approval.
I think they approved of it because they followed it. I don't know if they specifically used the word with approval.
Okay. So if you had to say, is Arnold a majority view in jurisdictions around the United States?
No, I wouldn't say it is. I cited three cases going the other way, I believe. I think they cited two.
Federal circuits?
Right. But once you get outside of Wisconsin on an issue that you think is similar, you kind of take what's there, whether it's federal or state or I don't think it's a majority view, no, at all. As I said in my brief, very candidly, it goes both ways. And the other courts where both sides cited basically, laid out the issues, and some did a very broad reading of the ensuing cause of loss clause, and some did a very narrow. And that's one of my points about Arnold. Arnold thinks it did a broad reading of the exclusion. And I'm saying, no, I don't think, with all due respect, they fully comprehended their own ruling, because I think by putting in that secondary cause requirement and saying, okay, just this little bit of damage that occurred subsequent to the power washing, that's covered. To me, that's a narrow construal of the ensuing cause of loss.
So let's go back to summary judgment.
Yeah.
Is there anything in the record that shows that there's a second, that a certain amount of this rain damage is, or a certain amount of the damage in the house is caused by this one rainstorm? Is there any expert testimony that talks about the rainstorm and that be, and the water damage being caused solely by that rainstorm? Is there anything segregated out to refute your experts' testimony?
I submit there is not, because I took those depositions, and they could not testify, and they admitted in their brief that they could not say what caused the water intrusion. They could not say that it was only from the storm. We don't deny that some of it's from the storm on May 11, 2018, but unequivocally, our people say it goes back to the very beginning. And that's what they never refuted on the other side.
Can I, going back to, because I'm just still back to Arnold, but I think I understand what you're saying. Do you agree that a rain event could be a cause of an ensuing loss? But are you saying that here, the water came from all kinds of things and it didn't, the ensuing loss of the rain event wasn't the cause? Is that what you're saying, how you distinguish Arnold?
Not quite. Let me try to rephrase it. Arnold was a close case on ensuing loss. In terms of the court saying, okay, the power washing stopped, all that damage, interior and exterior, is not covered, and it's not an ensuing loss. Then we get some rain sometime later, next day, 2 weeks, who knows? And that's a secondary event and a secondary cause. What our point is here, and the cases we cite from other jurisdictions back us up on this, is that the causation here never stopped. Okay, it never ever, because once that those openings and defects that were allowing water intrusion, once those were built into the house, the water intrusion never stopped. So it would be like if they were power washing constantly, in this case, and the power washing never stopped, and there's no secondary event.
Okay, so but you are not disputing the result of Arnold, that a rain event could be an ensuing loss under other circumstances.
That's a little broad.
Well,
I'm saying Arnold was close, and but I'm saying it's very narrow.
But the damages in Arnold weren't for the whole amount of damage done by water coming into the house.
Correct.
The experts were able, or people were able, to discern what damage occurred from the rain event versus what damage occurred from the other event. And here at summary judgment, there was zero presented to indicate that there was that separation and ability. Correct.
Right, because the water intrusion never stopped. The day the house was built, the water intrusion never stopped. The construction defect was allowing water in the house constantly. There was no secondary event.
And you're basing that on what?
On the facts.
That assertion.
Well, on the
you
facts.
Say the facts. Based on what?
Huh?
Based on what? What? Who?
Our expert testimony. That's all in the brief. I don't have the sites in my head, but
I didn't see an expert that said that he knows for sure that he testified that rain was coming in from the day of the building. I didn't see that in here.
It's in there.
How could they say that?
In there.
You keep talking about facts as if we know all of them and there's been a jury trial. We're talking about what the judge had before the judge at the time of summary judgment. So if you could, if your remarks could stick to the record at the time of summary judgment, I think that would be helpful, because as far as I understand it, you had experts that said this rain event cannot be in any way segregated out from the rain entering for a long period of time from the house. And the other side couldn't and didn't present anything at summary judgment to refute that. Is that correct?
Yes, and I believe that's in my brief. And I mean, I don't have it in my head, the sites, but it's cited in my brief, and I can, you know, court, if you want more briefing, you know, a couple pages, I can give you sites where our experts clearly and unequivocally testified that this was ongoing from the day the house was built, and the other side did not refute it. And that's in my brief more than once.
Counsel, I want to, I'm sorry, would you finish?
Go ahead, Justin.
I have a couple questions, and maybe I'll just pick up on that one. My first is, Ania, who testified in the summary judgment proceedings, he said, I don't think there was a gap. And I don't think that even if you had that, it could travel up on over 12, 14 feet, however long that is. That's not plausible. Do you think that creates a genuine issue of material fact as to whether that the damages were caused by construction, by that particular construction defect that you're expert concluded was there?
Can you tell me what he said again?
First of all, I don't think there really was a gap. I think that if this is the condition he saw it, I can see how that would look like a gap, but the stucco would have filled that gap. The flashing is there. Like I said, the kickout flashing in the gutter is there. And the damage, this is kind of relevant to what I was saying earlier. The damage in one of his drawings, he notes like this red area, areas in red, because of damage, and he concludes, I don't know how water would get in a one-inch hole on the far left side and travel up and over 12, 14 feet, however long that is. It just doesn't seem plausible.
No, I don't think that creates an issue of fact, because Anaya and or Carls both admitted that the gap was causing water intrusion, and they found two gaps, one in the front and one in the back. So I don't know which gap he's talking about there, but no, I don't believe that creates an issue of fact. And I don't recall the other side arguing that that created an issue of fact. Otherwise, they would have addressed it. And I don't believe they did.
Okay. I'll leave the opposing counsel to maybe address that further. My second question is, I'm still struggling on your understanding of ensuing loss. I'm going to put Arnold to the side for a minute and the facts of this case aside for just a minute. Could you give me some examples of the line drawing here between when a construction defect causes a loss and when a construction defect occurs, but we're going to cover an ensuing loss due to a secondary cause? I'm just having a hard time figuring out, frankly, how you make that decision.
Well, first of all, I don't make it. I argue it.
Understood. What the policy language, the line the policy language tend to draw, right?
No, I understand.
Interpreting a contract here.
I understand your question. Yes. I just wanted to clarify, in case my client watches this video, that I'm not
saying. Yes, I understand.
Not you're quoting them.
You're arguing the language. Yes.
I would say this. The question again is, what you wanted an example of.
Put aside Arnold. Put aside this case. Give me some hypotheticals. Yep. How does this work?
I can think of the best one I can think of. Was articulated in the Lillard-Roberts case that we cited. I think it was that one, where the insurer in that case said, okay, water intrusion from a construction defect is not an ensuing cause of loss for some of the same reasons that we've argued here. And then the hypothetical the insurer gave, which I believe the court accepted, is that, but let's say this water intrusion causes an electrical short, which causes a fire. That's a separate event, a separate cause, and that's an ensuing loss. That's the best one I can come up with.
What's the secondary cause there? Is it the water or is it the fire?
It's the water causing a short.
Okay. So water intrusion from a constructing defect is never an ensuing loss? Is that your position?
Not unless it causes some further event other than just the damage that water causes. Here you had water, in Lillard-Roberts, you had water causing additional damage beyond just what water does.
Yeah.
It started a fire.
Okay. One other quick question. Did you paid $2,183 for that? It seemed to be represented that that was for some form of ensuing loss. But then in your reply brief, you said, well, we're not saying it was for ensuing loss, but if it was, we reserve the right to change our mind. You paid some money for some damages here that looked to have an interpretation of the policy that's different than perhaps what you're arguing today, which maybe is fine. I'm just trying to figure out what in the world you think that was for.
The Court of Appeals came up with a holding that I don't believe was argued or briefed by either side theretofore. So I was responding to that. I think that's what you're getting at.
No, I'm not talking about the Court of Appeals at all. You paid $2,183 to in damages, right?
Okay, yes.
Okay. And was that because there was some thought that this was an ensuing loss?
I think that's what the letter of partial denial made that statement.
Okay. And so is your position that you were wrong in that? You shouldn't have paid out that money based upon your interpretation now?
I don't have a position on that today because there's nothing on that in the record.
Nothing
at all that I can see in the record as to what Cincinnati's thinking was when it paid that $2,183. They paid it. But I don't know what they're thinking.
I have the letter in front of me. I have actually both the letters. One was sent July 17, 2018, which was that says the letter serves to advise you of your insurance coverage regarding the above claim. And then there is a letter about 18 months later. I'm sorry, about 6 months later, 7 months later on February 21st, 2019, which references the July 17, 2018 letter. And this letter says, by letter dated July 17, 2018, the first letter, Cincinnati reserved rights partially accepted and partially denied coverage for the above captioned claim. Cincinnati paid the $10,000 limit of liability of the fungi, thank you. On July 17, 2018, here's the important part, and paid $2,138.53 on the same date for items that may have fallen within the ensuing cause of loss exception to the construction defect exclusion. So it certainly looks like, according to these letters, that Cincinnati, at least believed at the time these letters were written, that the ensuing loss exception to the construction defect exclusion allowed Cincinnati to pay out that money.
My red light is on. You want me to answer that?
If you
sure do. Following the rules, I'm more than happy to answer.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
First of all, it said may have been an ensuing cause of loss.
May have fallen within the ensuing.
And I don't know of anything in the record that has any that shows what the reasoning was in making that payment. They made it and they said it may have been an ensuing loss, but they didn't say it actually was. So I don't think there's anything in the record, and I can't start making statements about what Cincinnati meant when it's not in the record.
Are you aware of any legal principle that would allow this court to say, because you might have paid a couple thousand dollars, now we can hold that against you and say there's an issue of fact?
No, there isn't. I don't think there is any such legal doctrine. I think the doctrine is to the opposite. If you look at the Shannon case from way back in the 80s, I think, and the Maxwell case from, I want to say, 2012, the court made very clear that there is no waiver into coverage based on positions that the insurer may have taken.
And are settlement negotiations usually part of something that a court can use against one party or the other?
Generally not. That's my understanding, is if it's a settlement discussion, no, it can't be used. There are some limited purposes, but no, settlement discussions can't be used.
Council, just one quick question. Are you aware of any ensuing loss cases that don't involve water damage?
There are some. I didn't read them in connection with this case because this case is a very, you know, there's a series of cases, as you can see, on water damage and when and whether it's an ensuing loss. And we obviously argued and cited Arnold. There's this case we're here for, and then there's the out of jurisdiction cases that both sites, but I'm sure there are others. I just didn't read any, and I probably read some of them over the years, but I didn't read any of them for this proceeding today. Okay.
Questions? Justice Bradley, do you have any questions?
I do not. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Barton.
Bear with me. He's a little taller. Chief Justice Karofsky, and may it please the court. My name is James Barton, and I represent the respondents in this matter, Dr. James Rapicki and Dr. Rebecca Lightfuss. This case is here today because Cincinnati says the Court of Appeals destabilized Wisconsin insurance law. Respectfully, the exact opposite is true. What unsettles the law is granting summary judgment to an insurer who never proved the predicate facts necessary to invoke the policy exclusions it used to deny coverage in the first instance. And further compounding that problem is when the insurer advances an interpretation of those exclusions that either directly conflict with other coverage provisions in the policy, as is the case in the fungi exclusion, or strive to engraft on additional hurdles to finding coverage nowhere found in the policy, as is in the case of the construction defect and the ensuing loss provisions. This court has been clear over and over again that coverage determinations are often bound up in the facts and can't be resolved on summary judgment without a trial on the merits. That is exactly what happened here. Cincinnati fell well short of establishing that the construction defect and fungi exclusions even implied in the first instance, let alone that they caused the Rapicki's loss to bar coverage as a matter of law.
Could you then address that directly? Could you tell us exactly what evidence you put forward at the summary judgment stage that you think creates genuine issues of material fact with respect to the, in particular, the construction defect exclusion, and also the, and I don't know whether it's fungi or fungi, we're having a debate up here, but not, you are as well, so I don't know the answer.
Yes, Justice Hagedorn, and I'll be mindful of opinion that, or a oral argument I had before Judge Easterbrook one time, where he told me that counselor arguing facts to an appellate court is a complete waste of time. However, this one's kind of unique in the sense that the court is here to review certain legal questions on how to interpret the policy that you can't really get to until you almost have to assume that it was true as to what they proved. And I would submit to this court, Your Honors, that at the end of the day, that's simply not the case. And Justice Hagedorn, what I'll specifically get at, let me answer your question, and then I'm going to go more broadly, okay? May 11, 2018, there's a loss. That loss is reported to Cincinnati. Cincinnati recommends to the Rapickies to come out and that they should hire a engineer to determine what the source of the loss was. Cincinnati provided the name of Mr. Krizan of Infratech Engineering. Mr. Krizan then shows up on June 7th, 2018, and conducts a cursory inspection after the Rapickies had hired contractors to take down some of the siding on the back of the home to determine where the source of this loss was coming from. He did a visual inspection. It lasted a few hours. He didn't ask for any information regarding how the house was built, no blueprints. He never asked for blueprints of the house. He never inquired into the service or maintenance history of the home. He never sought to confirm whether the gap he identified as the source of the water in the back of the house was a more pervasive problem in other areas. He also later admitted in his deposition testimony that the gap in his report was likely smaller because that siding was removed to allow him to inspect it, but he never discussed that issue with anyone. And I'll talk about some other problems with his report later, Justice Hagedorn, but I want to get
to we want to know what the genuine questions of material fact are.
Absolutely,
we're not holding you in there.
Absolutely, Justice.
At summary judgment, submitted an affidavit or testimony.
Exactly.
Not generally allegations.
Exactly. Here's what happened, ultimately. Crozon opined, and Cincinnati's coverage opinion entirely rests on the fact that after he did a visual inspection on the in his July 7, 2018 report, he found two alleged defects. One was in the rear of the home, the one-inch gap. The other one that we'll talk about based on some questions earlier was in the front of the home. Later on, after testimony occurred, Mr. Herman, who was one of the contractors present with Mr. Crozon, testified in no uncertain terms that the gap that Mr. Crozon identified in the back of the home, that is the subject of this litigation, was never there because he created it. That is specifically at record 246 at page 207. It's a condensed transcript, Justice Ziegler. So you would look at page 36, lines 5 through 8.
So am I understanding you correctly that there's a dispute as to whether or not there was a construction defect?
Yes, there is. Absolutely, Justice Prudisaylis.
That's what we're looking for.
100%. Because the defect that Crozon identified, it didn't even exist.
I just need you to back up from my mind for a second. Is your argument that their experts didn't say enough to get here, or summary judgment? Or is your argument their experts may say this, but my experts say this?
There are.
Which is it? And if it's my experts say this, that's exactly what we're looking for from you. If it's, I'd like to cross-examine their experts on this, but we really didn't submit anything, I'd like to know that too.
Understood, Justice Ziegler. It's both. I think there are severe deficiencies with Mr. Crozon's report that I've identified. And as we've pointed out, a jury could, based off all of this other information, could completely disregard his report, because far from proving it as a matter of law, I think his opinion is incredible as a matter of law for reasons that I will get to. But to get to your specific point, Justice Ziegler, Mr. Herman, who was not an expert, testified the gap didn't even exist. And ultimately, Justice Hagedorn tapped on the exact language from Mr. Ania, our expert, the record at 264 at page 47. Again, it's a condensed transcript. It's pages 179, lines 25 to 180, line 22. And right there, what Mr. Ania says is that it is impossible, excuse me, he used the word implausible, that what Mr. Crozon identified as this one-inch gap could have ever been the source of the water and what caused this problem, let alone because Mr. Herman ultimately said the gap was never even there. We created it the day before Mr. Crozon showed up. But even more importantly, if you go to Dr. Rapicki's testimony, the morning of the loss when he testified, and the site for this is record 246, the transcript page number is 26, line 6 to page 27, line 20, okay? Dr. Rapicki woke up to a violent rainstorm that morning. It was so loud it woke him up. He walks downstairs into the great room of the home, okay? It's 16 feet wide. Water was pouring in across that entire 16 feet. Coming up, his testimony is, quote, it was coming up over the top of the windows and right down the whole wall of the great room, okay? So if you look at Crozon's July 7th, 2018 report, all right, we have it, actually a picture of it in our brief, on page 13 of our brief. You'll see where this gap allegedly is. It's marked as A. And then Mr. Crozon, traces where he thinks the water went. What Dr. Rapicki testified to, and to your point, Justice Hagedorn, what Mr. Ania was talking about why it was implausible, is because to accept Crozon's opinion, you'll see here, the water would need to literally come in this one-inch gap that, again, Mr. Herman said didn't even exist, travel horizontally and defy the laws of gravity and go 16 feet to establish what Mr. Rapicki saw that day. It simply was not there. And that was the entire point that we've stated over and over again. The reason in summary judgment, we said they never even proved this one-inch gap even existed. Now, what Mr. Rattan is talking about, and with all due respect to my adversary, is he is taking gross, gross liberties with the record. Recall earlier, you were asking, Justice Hagedorn, originally when Mr. Crozon came out, right, he identified two alleged defects, okay? How he said that they were original construction defects when he never reviewed the blueprints, he never reviewed the plans, he never asked for any information regarding the history of the home, he never looked around, that he readily acknowledged in his second deposition that he never even looked around to see if this one-inch gap that he saw was a more pervasive problem. He did none of that, okay? Nonetheless, based off that opinion, based on a few visual observations, the one-inch gap that's at issue right now in this case is on photo 10 of his report. The one-inch, the other gap that he noticed that he claimed was alleged construction defect was on the front of the home, and that was photo 12 of his report, all right? Following that, he then issues his report, and ultimately, Cincinnati bases its entire coverage opinion specifically on that information, okay?
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt. If we were to find in your favor that there are material disputes of fact with respect to the construction defects, what do we do then? Do we stop our analysis there and reverse the circuit court's determination that, you know, grant a summary judgment, or should we reach the issues about the scope of the ensuing loss exception? What are you asking us to do if we find that there's a dispute about the defects?
Thank you, Justice Crawford. Well, I think that the Court of Appeals decision can be affirmed in all respects. Yes, not only were there disputed issues of material fact, okay? But as the Court of Appeals recognized, and because this litigation has been now going on for almost a decade, even if you were to accept Cincinnati's position, right, the point remains that, as Justice Dallet was alluding to earlier, Arnold's been on the books for more than 22 years. And I would submit to this court, as we get into that, all the Court of Appeals did is correctly apply what's been the law, and not only the law, and has been lauded by courts all over the country.
Well, and I hear your opposing counsel not asking us to overturn Arnold.
Right.
They believe Arnold supports their analysis. So can you get into how you interpret Arnold as in your client's favor?
Sure. No problem, Justice Crawford. At the end of the day, Cincinnati says that it doesn't want this court to overrule Arnold, but that's not really the case, okay? At the end of the day, what Cincinnati argued, right, is that the Court of Appeals erroneously expanded Arnold's holding because it did not consider whether the water infiltration was a separate and independent cause of the loss. You heard my adversary reference proximate causation. In the cause, where the court would need to demarcate and determine where the one loss starts and the new loss begins. Judge Abrahamian before the trial court glommed onto that, okay, and actually specifically found that Arnold was inapplicable because the stormwater infiltration that damaged the Rapicki's home was not a separate and independent cause of loss. In support of that position, Mr. Rattan cites the three cases, the Sixth Circuit decision in TMW, the Eighth Circuit decision in Friedberg, and the District of Oregon opinion Lillard-Roberts. Every single one of those cases has rejected exactly what Arnold held, every single one. What those cases did, whether because the policy language was different or because the courts interpreted Arnold differently, is they engrafted in that whole separate and independent cause language or that proximate cause analysis. That is exactly what Arnold rejected. The court just needs to look at paragraphs 25 and 40 of the Arnold opinion. See, in that case, Cincinnati's position is an ensuing loss clause applies, quote, only if there is a peril that is separate and independent in nature, which preceded it, that is not covered. That's exactly how Cincinnati is asking about that's exactly what they're saying here.
Take a look at 29, though. The Arnolds are apparently of the view that it's reasonable to construe ensuing loss as all losses that follow or are a consequence of faulty workmanship. And then they say that's not reasonable. And then they specifically say, we conclude that a reasonable insured would understand that in addition to being a loss that follows as a chance, likely, or necessary consequence of the excluded loss, here's the kicker, an ensuing loss must result from a cause in addition to the excluded one. And so that's where we stand here on the record of them having some experts who say this is all from faulty workmanship. And then you've got to come forward and say, it's not from faulty workmanship, or it is from faulty workmanship, but we can prove that this extra part was caused by, you know, the language I just read. So what is that? I mean, where is your proof that the result, the ensuing loss resulted from a cause in addition to the excluded cause? That evidence that shows that at summary judgment.
Sure, Justice Eagler. I mean, well, the cause, no one disputes that the cause was the rain event. That was the cause.
So would that apply then? Let's just say you've got faulty workmanship and there's rain. Why wouldn't ensuing loss cover that?
Precisely as what Arnold said.
No, it's not what Arnold said. Arnold said, you might have faulty workmanship and you might have water coming in your house, but you've got to have that second causation and second kind of quantifiable result. I mean, Arnold wasn't sent back for a trial on all the water damage.
I believe it was remanded for factual disputes to determine, arcade between the two losses.
But they weren't allowed to recover for all the water damage. So the point is here at this point, you need to kind of demonstrate, don't you, that this either wasn't from faulty workmanship, so it's not even under the exclusion, or that it might be from faulty workmanship, but there's a separate causal event.
Yes, Your Honor, I want to be clear. Arnold base is, as I understand the decision, Justice Ziegler, Arnold said when they were power washing the house and the water that entered as a result of the power washing immediately when it happened, that's what's excluded.
Right.
Right. So, and the caulking that was damaged as a result of it, excluded. No one's arguing that this isn't turning no one's reading the construction defect exclusion to turn a Cincinnati or any other insurer into a warrantor of the contractor's work. That's not what's happening here, right? If you stop though, right, what happened then after is after the contractor was done damaging the home, it rained. And because it rained, once the home was damaged, more water got into the home. And as a result of that, that's what was covered.
I get that.
Okay.
But that's different, it seems, than what's been stated here. And that is, we have a gap. Water's been coming in. It's been coming in for some time, causing damage in the house. That's what they're saying. That's what the experts are saying. And that this rain event happened, but it just made it worse from what was already happening in the beginning. So then it's your job to say, okay, the rain's the second causal event, but here is what we're seeking for that second causal event. Or do you have something somewhere in the record that says the separate event in no way related to what their experts say in the record? I'm just trying to figure out the record at summary judgment. I'm sympathetic to your cause. Believe me, I am sympathetic. On the other hand, you have a contract and it excludes construction defects and you have expert testimony saying rain went in the house. It caused problems because of these construction defects. We don't have to cover for that. Do you think they have to cover for that? if rain came in the house from construction defects?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what Arnold, no, no, no. And I think this is where I don't envy the reviewing court up here, Your Honor, because we're doing this on the false premise that they even proved a construction defect in the first instance, right? The point is, and I think that what would guide the court and assist is to look at the District of Montana's decision in LEAP, which we cited, which does an excellent job, in my opinion. I'm not saying the court is subject to Montana law on this issue, but what LEAP does is it amalgamates all of the cases in terms of courts that have basically determined courts that have found or accepted a broad ensuing cause of loss provision, right? And courts that have the policy reasons or the bases for courts that have basically determined or taken a more narrow view of those. Okay. And in LEAP, which is, in LEAP, this is what the court said. First off, LEAP accepted LEAP front and center in LEAP was Arnold. Arnold was the case that LEAP championed as accepting a broad iteration of the ensuing loss doctrine. Okay. LEAP then cites to another case, Bartram, which is a Northern District of Florida decision dealing with original construction. Bartram, in turn, cites to Eckstein, which is another case from the Western District of Kentucky, which in turn cites back to Arnold. Okay. In that case, the facts of that case were this. They hired a contractor. He had to come fix the attic. Okay. During the course of whatever happened, there were allegations that a pipe in the attic the contractor came to fix the roof. During the course of those repairs, what happened is that apparently a pipe got disconnected. Okay. Fast forward, all of a sudden, homeowner notices that his house is leaking, goes up. Oh, how'd this pipe get disconnected? Gunfight ensues. All right. So what happened in that case is then the LEAP court needed to decide, the insurance company for the homeowner ultimately needed to determine, just like in Arnold and just like here, well, wait a second, was this a construction defect because the contractor made a mistake and ultimately this was faulty construction? Or alternatively, was this an ensuing cause of loss? And what the court did in that decision is it demarcated between it cataloged the jurisdictional split, right? It demarcated between those cases taking a broad position of ensuing causes of loss and those taking a narrow one. Front and center for the cases taking a broad one was Arnold, all right? For the for the jurisdictions taking a narrow version that contradicted Arnold and disagreed with its reasoning are the very three cases that Mr. Rattan cites and Cincinnati relies upon in its brief. The issue there and the reason that the court disagreed and ultimately sided with this Arnold line of cases is specifically TMZ, right? It says LEAP decisions at paragraph section 1084. Contrary to the cases which interpret the exclusion more narrowly, the average consumer untrained in the law would not naturally engage in approximate cause analysis of this language and attempt to determine whether a loss was direct and natural consequence of faulty workmanship or whether it resulted from a separate intervening cause. Moreover, there is nothing in the policy's plain language to indicate that the loss must be a separate and independent from the faulty workmanship. If an insurer wants to narrowly limit the ensuing loss provision to separate and independent causes, it may do so by drafting policy language to expressly exclude all losses that have resulted directly and proximately from an excluded peril. So, 22 years ago, when Cincinnati advanced over on almost identical policy language, hey, we need this separate and independent cause requirement, Arnold rejected it. Fast forward 22 years later, Cincinnati hasn't changed its policy language like it could have. In fact, the case that Cincinnati relies upon and places heavy stock on is TMW, okay? And if you look at section 575 of TMW, one of the reasons that TMW went to the narrow line of cases was not just because of how it interpreted the clause, it's, or not just because of its narrow construction of ensuing loss clauses, it's because the language was different in the exclusion itself.
So, quote, counsel, can I
interrupt
for a second? So are you getting to a point with respect to when you're saying narrow versus broad, the idea is that an insurer is in charge of the language? And so when we're reading the language, we would read it as an ordinary insured would read it. And then if Cincinnati wanted to draft it to say something otherwise, they could, because the position that an insured is in is they can't exactly negotiate insurance language. Is that part of
absolutely
the concept that you're
absolutely
about?
Justice Dallet, because if someone has a massive rainstorm in their home where water starts pouring into the house, you're going to call your insurance company to think it's covered, right? And if the insurance company wants to engraft into this proximate cause analysis or the separate and independent cause requirement, it can easily do so.
It could have done so after Arnold.
And it could have done so after Arnold, 100%. In fact, Arnold recognized as much, because when it was construing the policy, just like in this case, it said, well, wait a second. If you wanted to basically broaden this construction loss clause, this construction defect exclusion, why didn't you just dump it into the other policy section that basically was subject to an anti-concurrent cause of loss clause? The same holds here true. If Cincinnati wanted to expand the scope of this construction defect exclusion and not have it subject to an ensuing cause of loss provision, just as Arnold interpreted and as courts around the country have lauded, all it had to do was move it into the C4 exclusions.
Counsel, I wanted to just ask a couple questions. Justice Protasiewicz asked your opposing counsel about whether any non-water cases are informative at all for interpreting the ensuing loss. Curious if you have any awareness, information, or thoughts on that.
Your Honor, to be honest, most of them that I've seen do involve water. I can't think of one off the top of my head that doesn't. I know that TMZ did touch upon the separate and independent peril that water wouldn't count, but you need a fire. But I can't think of one that didn't involve water loss.
I also want to go back to Justice Crawford's question, the sort of what now question.
Right.
And if we, and I don't know if I totally got an answer for that. The Court of Appeals assumed that there might be disputed issues of fact on construction on the construction defect exclusion, or said there may be, but we're going to assume it applies,
right?
And then we're going to construe this ensuing loss provision.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to understand from a, like, we actually have to write this decision. So
I understand, Your Honor.
And so if there are, if you're right about your there being genuine issues of material fact on the construction defect exclusion, what should we do or say, which is different than what the Court of Appeals did and why?
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Well, guidance from the whole court would be helpful, but we recognize the situation you're in, that you have to make certain assumptions in order to reach issues where, respectfully, there are issues of disputed issues of material fact. As it relates to the fungi exclusion and how you reconcile those two, I think that you can look at the fungi exclusion. You can look at the fact that it says it does not apply if you have additional coverage, meaning that you have to read those two together in pari materia. And when you do so, you come to the conclusion that there's no way that they can both stand. That's a legal conclusion, and at best it's ambiguous, and the tie would go to the insured in that regard. As it relates to the construction defect exclusion and then the ensuing cause of loss provision, admittedly that gets trickier. It just does, because there was the assumption made. However, the Court of Appeals was correct insofar as it did apply Arnold. And to the extent that it did so, I would note that if there's any type of ambiguity in terms of how you should interpret this policy or how ensuing loss applies, maybe it was comfortable from doing so, because Chief Justice Karofsky touched on this earlier. The Cincinnati, I find it, with all due respect to my adversary, I find it remarkably disingenuous to come up here and excoriate the Court of Appeals and say they grossly misinterpreted Arnold, when Cincinnati's coverage position was the exact same in July of 2018 when it initially issued its report. The record at 245, page 26 of 305, explains exhibit G2 quoted above. Now recall, there was the alleged defect on the front of the house and the alleged defect on the back of the house, okay? The front of the house is in dispute. The front of the house is in dispute because Cincinnati paid it, right? Cincinnati said, oh, well, we think we might have seen, Crozon might have seen an original construction defect and it was a hole. And so as a result of that, there was some water that entered in the ceiling. So we'll give you your check for $2,100 as a result of that. The following ensuing cause of loss provision, however, partially reinstates coverage for some damage that are caused by the defective workmanship and materials. Based on the above quoted ensuing cause of loss provision, Cincinnati will pay the cost to repair and replace the following items of damage referenced in the following sections of the Infratech report. The record at 43 reflects that Cincinnati cut that check. And what I find very, very interesting about this is this, okay? If you look at Julie Didier, the claims adjuster's testimony, this wasn't some off-the-cuff policy opinion, off-the-cuff adjuster making, writing this letter. In fact, although Julie Didier signed that letter, when she was testified under oath, what did she say? I never wrote that letter. And we know at that time that Cincinnati had already retained coverage counsel. Okay.
Counsel, I appreciate this point. I just want to ask one other clarifying question.
Mm-hmm.
There's some debate between the Court of Appeals majority and the concurrence. Yes. I understand there's arguments in the briefing. I don't need to rehash that. My question actually for you is, does that actually make a practical difference? I understand there might be a jurisprudential and how we interpret policies that we may need to clarify one way or the other, given that. But I'm actually just curious whether it has a practical effect on the case for you.
Academically interesting, distinction without a difference, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Any other questions? Justice Bradley, do you have any questions?
I do not. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Thank you. There were some statements made by counsel, an oral argument that I just want to respond to briefly. At one point he said that we took liberties with the record. I don't take liberties with the record before this court.
Hold on just a second. I have a text from Justice Bradley that that her call dropped.
I just heard a beep.
Yep.
Hello.
Hello, are you back with us?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, I saw your text, I think, very soon after you sent it, but do you want to just start from the top of your of your rebuttal?
There were some what'd you say?
Start from the top of your rebuttal.
Yeah, I could talk. I could talk till 5 o'clock.
Your wife, but maybe another time.
Okay. There were some statements by counsel that we had taken liberties of the record. We did not take liberties of the record on this case. I have never done that in any case. And I think it had to do with the issue of where he said, they're challenging whether there was a construction defect at all, and in fact, that their experts deny that. We cited in our brief to the record their experts, Anaya and Carl. I asked them these questions at the deposition, and in terms of, I walked them through all the defects that Curzon found and asked if they were defects, and with a lot of them, if not all of them. They both admitted, yes, they are, and a properly constructed house should not be built that way. So that statement that we took liberties with the record on whether there's a causation defect simply are not accurate.
Well, counsel, I heard discussion of other people testifying. I mean, you could have a construction defect and you could have a rain event that caused damage and they may or may not be connected. We heard some points in the record that were other people's testimony. We wouldn't just have to have an expert to say that.
The other thing that they admitted their experts was they didn't know what caused it.
Right. I'm saying couldn't, isn't it true, let me forward it this way, that that to create a genuine issue of material fact, that it doesn't just have to be an expert that could create that genuine issue. It could be people's observations with their eyes.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
But if you're referring to Ms. Lightfoot saying that, oh, we never saw water before, that's speculation. To go from there to say, oh, well, then there must not.
No, I'm talking about the testimony about the doctor, or the deposition testimony of Dr. Rapicki about where the water actually came in from, if it came in over the windows, and I don't know. I mean, you seem to want us to only look at experts when it seems like the record is full of other types of testimony that you just are not discussing.
Well, his testimony that he saw where water is coming in does not establish an issue of fact as to whether it was caused by the construction defect going back to when the house was built in 2005. It doesn't do that. Okay, it's speculation to say otherwise. You have to say, okay, well, is that from a construction defect that's been going on for all these years and you just had a bad storm? Their experts admitted there were construction defects, and I cited that to the record. They also admitted they don't know what caused the loss. So therefore, I go back to my example where somebody says X is true, and that is actually admissible as evidence. Then the next person, their adversary, says, no, X is not true, but they have no facts or expert opinion or anything supporting it. And they say, I don't know, you know, or and that's where I made a mistake just a second ago. They don't say X is not true. They say, I don't know if X is true. That doesn't create an issue of fact. The I don't know doesn't create an issue of fact. Attacking the credibility under that scenario of the proponent's expert who says X is true, I mean, you can attack that all you want, as long as it's admissible, which it is, because there's been no argument anywhere in this case that Mr. Kazan's opinions are inadmissible. There's arguments that they're wrong, but not that they're inadmissible. So you have inadmissible evidence where he says this is from construction defects, and then you have the other side's expert saying, I don't know if it is or not. I don't know what caused it. Okay, then that doesn't create an issue of fact. And that's what they're doing here. And I see this from representing insurers and insurance coverage work, is they want to look at claim handling, because you can always ankle bite and nitpick at that forever and ever and ever. That's a bad faith issue in terms of how the claim was handled. Bad faith in this case appropriately stayed by the trial court for this court's decision in Bretthorst and the Court of Appeals decision prior thereto in Dahman. So it's stayed, and so counsel keeps in his argument and in the briefing getting into claim handling. Well, Kazan didn't do this. He didn't do
counsel,
that. Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have a couple of questions about the ensuing loss coverage. The way you characterize it, it sounds like kind of a but-for test. That if the construction, if not for the construction defect, the damage would have occurred, that there would be coverage. Is that accurate or no?
I am not sure I would go that far. I would say that when Arnold said there has to be a separate cause, that you are into the law of causation.
Right.
So
if the construction defect contributed to the loss, but there is an ensuing cause of loss, is there still coverage in that situation? Because that seems to me kind of what was going on in Arnold.
I can't answer. I'm sorry. It's too hypothetical. I can't answer that. It's just.
And well, part of the reason I'm asking is that it seems to me that under the way the Court of Appeals analyzed the ensuing loss coverage, that essentially what they're saying is water damage can never be excluded under the construction defect exclusion, because there's always an ensuing cause, that being rain, snow, some form of moisture showing up. And I'm struggling with that interpretation, because the policy language is a construction defect. If the construction defect causes the loss, it's excluded from coverage.
Well, I agree. The Court of Appeals held that all water damage is an ensuing loss, and that's one of the things we're appealing.
Yeah.
Because it's wrong. I don't know if that answers your question. I'm not
I guess
sure.
Kind
I can
of.
Go
I mean, the policy just says if the construction defect caused the loss, it's excluded. So
can you hold on just a second.
We lose Justice Bradley.
How do we lose?
I'm sorry. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. Yes, we lost Justice Bradley again.
I have to go. This has run over longer than for sure it was scheduled. But I will watch the remainder on the recording.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think she's on. The text says someone is pressing the buttons on the phone. Justice Bradley, are you with us?
I am.
Oh, we thought we dropped the call. So sorry.
No, I've been on since I rejoined after the first and only drop.
Okay. Just so you know, Justice Crawford asked a question. Justice Ziegler had to leave, but she's going to watch the remaining minutes of this on the video recording. I kind of lost track of where.
Yeah, let me just re-add where I think.
Yeah,
I
think that would be a good idea if you could please reframe the question.
Yeah. So the exclusion, the construction defect exclusion, the language in the policy. Says that it bars coverage for physical damage caused by defective construction. And what I'm trying to sort out here is where we've got water, as we did here, to what extent is that the physical damage caused by the water caused by the defective construction? Because the Court of Appeals certainly seemed to view the water occurrence, the rain occurrence, as an ensuing cause of that physical damage, not strictly speaking the construction defect. So how do you answer that?
How did the water get in? That's my answer. I mean, I know you're not supposed to answer a question with a question. The only evidence in this case of how the water got in was from the construction defect, and it never stopped from day one. I mean, moisture's coming into the house on a sunny, hot, humid summer day. Okay, fog, okay. Mm-hmm. So it never stopped. In Arnold, the causation stopped when they turned the power washer off. The weather never gets turned off, ever. Can't do it. Would like to when it's below zero, but can't.
So in other words, you have two houses next door to each other, same design. One has a construction defect, the other doesn't. There's a violent rainstorm. There's a water intrusion in the house with the construction defect. There's no intrusion in the house without the construction defect. You would attribute the water damage in the house with the defect as being caused by the defect.
Yes, with appropriate expert testimony, which we have here, yes.
Okay.
That would be it.
If there had been some water intrusion in house number two that does not have a construction defect, just because of the force of the storm, let's say, that an ordinary house just can't sustain that. What's the result in that case then? Is the water damage in house one with the construction defect barred, or is it not barred?
I hadn't thought of that before I came in today, but if...
Because I think that's a little bit what the homeowner is arguing here, or possibly.
Well, if you have a perfectly fine constructed house with no defects and a tornado comes and knocks it down, you don't get into ensuing cause issues.
Yeah.
Or a hurricane or a bad storm that causes damage.
And we don't know how bad this storm was because I don't think the record really reflects that. But in theory, at least, a sufficiently severe storm could cause water damage in a house without regard to whether there's a construction defect.
Yeah, it can. Like I said, a tornado would be one example.
So why is that not a fact question in this case?
Because their experts couldn't come up with anything to refute mine. I asked them in depositions, what caused the water? We don't know. My people say construction defect caused the water, and so on and so forth. They said, we don't know.
Okay.
And like I said, we don't know loses every time up against somebody who has admissible testimony as to whether something's true.
Counsel, I have one other follow-up, and that is, can you give me an example of something that's covered by the ensuing loss provision that wouldn't be covered if it wasn't there?
What I said earlier, which is the Lillard case, where the court, I believe, accepted the insurer's hypothetical that you have water intrusion causes damage, and that in turn causes an electrical short. You get a spark and a fire. The fire is an ensuing cause of loss. The water damage is not.
Wouldn't that be just covered generally under the policy?
I'd have to look at the policy. I'm sorry to be so careful, but
I'm trying to just figure out if the ensuing loss covers something that's not, you know, it means something as an exception to the construction defect, but.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Justice Bradley, any questions?
No, thank you.
Great, thank you.
Yes, thank you for your arguments today. We meet in closed conference.
We are directed.